May it please the court. James Hardy, attorney number 38173 for the appellant Vincent Palomo. I intend to save about 5 minutes today for rebuttal.
Okay.
I'll focus my remarks on issue 3 in the briefs. This issue concerns whether the trial court had discretion under Colorado's cost statute, section 18.1.3701, to award costs of prosecution against Palomo that were necessary only to prosecuting charges of which Mr. Palomo was acquitted. This is a statutory interpretation question and appears to be one of first impression in this jurisdiction. Mr. Palomo should not be assessed these costs for at least three reasons. First, longstanding Colorado law and the plain language of the Colorado cost statute prohibits it. Second, numerous other courts who have looked at similar circumstances and statutory language have uniformly found defendants may not be assessed with costs necessary only to acquitted charges. And third, the rules of statutory interpretation, construction, and policy support Palomo's position as well.
I ask you about your first reason.
Yes, Judge Allen, of course.
If longstanding Colorado law prohibits it, why is this an issue of first impression?
Well, potentially because it's been quite obvious up until now that that the defendants aren't responsible for costs that are necessary only to charges of which they've been acquitted.
What's the longstanding Colorado published authority that prohibits it?
Published authority that's cited in the briefs are these turn of the 20th century cases, Bransom and Wilson, the Board of County Commissioners cases, which provide that an acquitted defendant may not be assessed costs of prosecution for charges with which, when those charges result in acquittal.
Those cases based on the statute that's currently in effect?
Those cases are based on prior statutory language, I believe. However, the legislature is presumed aware of those cases in enacting the current cost statute that we're dealing with here. And the language of the current cost statute, which reads in relevant part, where any person is convicted of an offense, the court shall give judgment against the offender for the amount of the cost of prosecution, doesn't expressly talk about a case where you have some charges that result in acquittal and some charges that result in conviction. What it does provide is a conviction of an offense, singular offense and a specific offense, relating that to the cost award for the amount of the cost of prosecution. Now, Mr. Palomo's position is that this plain language links the cost of prosecution to the conviction of an offense, specific offense. And considering that the longstanding principle of Colorado law that an acquitted defendant is not responsible for cost of prosecution, and I don't think there's any dispute here between the state and Mr. Palomo that a defendant who is acquitted of all charges in a case could be charged with cost of prosecution. Given that, this language indicates the legislative intent that in a situation like this one, where you have some charges resulting in acquittal and some in conviction, the defendant's only responsible for the costs that were necessary to the prosecution of the conviction.
Counsel didn't object to the assessment of costs at the sentencing hearing.
Counsel did not object at the sentencing
hearing. So why isn't it waived?
Counsel objected in writing within 3 business days of the order of the sentencing hearing. And Judge Roy, if you look at the transcript of that sentencing hearing, the events play out like this. They're mid-sentencing. Defense counsel has just finished her opening remarks, and the prosecutor makes record that it's at that time delivering the motion for cost of prosecution to defense counsel and states on the record that defense counsel hasn't had an opportunity to review it, hasn't had an opportunity to talk about it with her client. The sentencing hearing proceeds from that point on. There's no more mention of cost of prosecution. When the trial court gives the sentencing order, it doesn't mention cost of prosecution. The minute order from the same day doesn't mention cost of prosecution. Mr. Palomo's position on that record is that defense counsel had no reasonable opportunity to object under those circumstances, and the written objection within 3 business days of clearly finding out that the court had ordered these costs of prosecution without a hearing, without argument, is timely and preserves this issue. I would also point to a panel of this court's fairly recent decision in People v. Scoggins, in which the court interpreted the cost of prosecution statute allowing the prosecution to make a timely motion for cost of prosecution 5 months after the sentencing hearing. Under those circumstances, applying that general proposition of reasonableness, I don't think it can be said that Mr. Palomo has waived the issue on appeal in this case. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, the numerous other jurisdictions that have addressed this set of circumstances have uniformly found that a criminal defendant cannot be charged with costs of prosecution in connection with charges in connection with costs necessary only to charges resulting in acquittal. Some of those cases have language that frankly I think is would argue more strongly for the Attorney General's points, with the Attorney General's interpretation of the Colorado cost statute. For instance, in State v. Faulkner, Wyoming, 1956, the Wyoming Supreme Court, the statutory language that the court interpreted there read, in all cases of a conviction of an offense, the court shall render judgment against the defendant for the cost of prosecution. Now, really, the only distinction between this language and the language here for the Colorado cost statute is the other language reads, in all cases. We don't have that language in the Colorado cost statute. And yet, even though the Faulkner language includes in all cases, that court still found as a matter of law that a defendant could not be found liable for costs that are necessary only to prosecute charges resulting in acquittal.
Well, I want to understand what your primary position is. Is your initial position that when you have multiple counts, acquittals on some, convictions on others, that as a matter of law, you cannot have costs assessed on any of the counts on which the defendant is acquitted?
That is a fair rendering, Judge Loeb. I would say that my position is, as a matter of law, the trial court doesn't have discretion to award costs that were only reasonable and only necessary to prosecute the counts resulting in acquittal.
That's different.
In other words, the court has discretion to award costs that were necessary to cost to prove the counts resulting in conviction, but as a matter of law, no discretion to.
Well, what do you do with the people's argument that if the counts are somehow related and the costs are related, then the court, if it finds they're intertwined, can impose costs?
Well, in the first place, I would point out that is a question for the trial court under those circumstances. But many times, and I think in this case is a fine example of it, it's not going to be very difficult to separate out the costs related to the charges resulting in conviction and the charges resulting in acquittal.
But that's not something we can do on appeal, is it?
I would submit that in this case, it's so clear that the court could vacate the cost order in this case if it adopts the interpretation of the statute that Mr. Palermo is advocating. However, generally speaking, no, I think that a remand would be necessary for the court to hear the facts and parse out which costs related to or were necessary to prove which counts and which ones went to the convictions and which ones went to the acquitted charges. So as I was saying, that State v. Faulkner, under that language, the court still found as a matter of law, much like Mr. Palermo is arguing for here, that you could not assess cost of prosecution to a defendant that were only necessary to counts that resulted in acquittal. And the procedural facts of that case are interesting because I think they highlight the potentially absurd result that results in the Attorney General's interpretation of the statute here. In Faulkner, the defendant had been charged below with 47 different counts and was acquitted of 46 of those. The trial court, reading the language that I quoted earlier, assessed that defendant for the cost of the entire prosecution, all 46 acquitted counts and the one conviction. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Wyoming said, if the prosecution had chosen to try these cases in 47 different cases, we would have no authority under the statutory language, or the trial court would have no authority under the statutory language to have assessed the defendant for those costs. And the court saw no reason to apply a different logic in the case where the prosecution charged all the counts in the same case rather than in 47 different ones. Likewise, I pointed out in the reply brief a couple of instances where you could have numerous complex to prove, complex to prosecute, expensive to prosecute charges that result in acquittal of a criminal defendant on all those charges, and yet the defendant, under the Attorney General's rendering, could be responsible for the entire cost of the prosecution if they got convicted of, say, a petty offense or something that was relatively minor compared to the other charges, like a criminal trespassing, something to that effect.
Counsel, let me interrupt you a minute. Could you turn down the sound a bit? We're getting some feedback. Okay, go ahead. Pardon me.
I'm sorry, Judge Roy. I'll try to be closer to the microphone. That'll solve the problem. Now, Mr. Bellomo's position is that the plain language of the statute dictates the result, this result. If this court were to find that the statute is ambiguous as to this question, however, all the tools of statutory construction, interpretation, and policy dictate in favor of Mr. Bellomo's position as well, including the rule of lenity, the rule that cost award statutes are in derogation of the common law and should be strictly construed, and the fact that this court must presume that the legislature intended a just and reasonable result. And again, other jurisdictions, all these cases are cited in the briefs, including several federal courts, are uniform and find that costs necessary only to charges of acquittal can't be assessed against a defendant.
You got about 4 minutes left.
Yes, and I'd like to say the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Judge Wright.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White. My attorney registration number is 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. I would like to focus on the defendant's third argument that the trial court improperly imposed the cost of prosecution. Initially, this court should not address this claim because the defendant waived it by not objecting to the cost associated with the prosecution when given the opportunity to do so.
I think I want to ask you about that, because the record shows that there was simply a motion handed to counsel during the hearing. No advance warning, just here's our motion that everybody conceded defense counsel hadn't had a chance to look at. So you're saying, in effect, that defense counsel should have, while he's doing all these other things relating to sentencing, read through the motion and determine how to object to specific items of costs at the hearing.
Yes, I mean, I think that if you have an opportunity to object, and I think if you a careful review of the specific date, this at the sentencing hearing, the prosecution says, I have a motion for costs. I also have an order or regarding the destruction of evidence, and counsel has not had an opportunity to go over it with her client. So I think it's not clear what they're actually talking about with respect to what they have. But granted, I think it's a proposed instruction that the prosecution hands to the court. However, the order does reflect that it was done in open court.
Well, let's look at that. We have a transcript of the sentencing.
Right.
It's not there.
But it is on the order. The order specifically states done in open court.
Well,
so it was signed and granted in open court.
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, since it's not in the transcript, all that means is that that's boilerplate language, or else the judge came into the courtroom and signed it at some later point. I mean, the transcript doesn't show that that's what happened. And the transcript doesn't show any consideration of this issue at the sentencing hearing.
But I think that I have the motion for cost of prosecution, knowing what happened in this case, the defendant had an opportunity to object.
But how could he reasonably object? How would he know? I mean, he's given this motion for the first time. He's in the midst of a hearing. He doesn't know whether to make a general objection, whether to object to this cost or that cost. There's no way that a trial lawyer could have done that under those circumstances.
No, I think at the very least, the defendant could have said, I haven't had an opportunity. I object, or I would like more time to review this. And I think that, you know, he did have an opportunity. Although there's many things going on, it's, you know, his opportunity is there, and his obligation is to object to something at that time. And I think that he clearly did not do that.
Why is the object at that time? Begs the whole question of whether he had a meaningful opportunity to review the motion and determine, analyze it, to determine what bases there might be for objecting. I mean, this is not something that he was prepared for.
But I think
he has to go back and look at the record. Look at these, you know, these witness costs. What did these witnesses testify to? All this other kind of stuff. I mean, how is counsel supposed to do that in the midst of a hearing?
Well, I think that they're aware that the costs are for the expert fees, the out-of-state witnesses, and subpoena costs. And I think at that time, defense counsel knows what specific expert fees, which witnesses were experts, and as well as which witnesses were out-of-state. So I don't think that, you know, this is an unreasonable. I think that they did have an opportunity to object. I'm saying they could have said, I need more time to review this. I'm, you know, stating an objection. I'd like an additional time to review this and to go through the record. And I think that the trial court would have been more than willing to give that.
Maybe. I mean, we don't know. The trial court didn't give any indication to counsel that it was intending to just simply enter the order that day.
Well, I think I have a motion.
Yeah, I have a motion. Yeah, and as somebody who used to practice law, if when I go into court and somebody handed me a written motion, I usually thought I had some time to respond, usually in writing, to that kind of a motion. I didn't think I could get sandbagged that way and just get a ruling with no indication by the court that it was ruling on the motion.
I still think that, you know, at that time you object and request more time. And so based on that, I think that, you know, it's clear that he did waive this issue. However, I understand that the objection was made within 5 days after, but I still think that he had an opportunity at that time to object.
And establish a standard of practice that's binding on the prosecutor also?
Which was
that any motion handed to him in the middle of a hearing, he has to object to or it's waived?
I think that's, I mean, especially with restitution case law, which is analogous here, I think that can be, you know, what a trial court said or what an appellate court says. If you haven't objected at the time, and I think the Scoggins case is with respect
to... My question is, do you want the prosecutors held to the same standard that you're saying should apply to defense counsel here?
That they should object?
They should object to it in a hearing after they've been handed to it, even though they don't have the faintest idea of what it says.
I think with respect to restitution and costs and sentencing issues, I think that is a fair... I think that's...
But we shouldn't hear motions for costs that are filed after 90 days following the plea.
I think that the statute is clear on that you have to enter an order at that time, and it might not be the specific amount, but the statute specifically says a restitution order must be entered, and if it's not, I think that you're right, the prosecution has a problem there.
To extend your argument, why is restitution and costs any different from any other motion? What if the defendant comes into a hearing on some other subject and says, I have a motion to dismiss. Here it is, Mr. Prosecutor.
Well, I think that's clearly, I mean, this is after all the evidence has been presented. We're at a very different stage than different motions throughout the trial.
Evidence of cost has not been presented. The defendant has the right to challenge that and ask for a hearing, doesn't he?
I think... I'd like to go on to the plain language of the statute because I think that it clearly covers these costs.
Can I, and I apologize for doing this. I just want to kind of skip ahead a little bit. Let's assume you're right about the statutory interpretation. But as I understand your argument in the answer brief, it's that all these costs were intertwined between all the charges, and therefore it was within the trial court's discretion to award all of them.
Well, I think first of all, the plain language is clear. And so I think it covers these costs because it says an offense. So I think that under that perspective, you know, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. It doesn't say the costs related to a conviction. However,
what if the prosecution is completely unsuccessful? Under your interpretation, the state gets its cost. There has
Absolutely.
Been a prosecution.
I think that is clearly not. I mean, if the defendant is acquitted of all of the charges, I think, however, if he's convicted of an offense.
But the statute doesn't say conviction, like you point out.
It's it says prosecution. An offense.
But it's got prosecution. Doesn't that beg the question? It has to be a successful prosecution,
right?
I.e.,
a
conviction.
To be convicted of an offense, which is a successful prosecution.
Right. So you're trying to parse out. You're trying to make a distinction between, or assume that the legislature used the word prosecution in some sense different than conviction here, even though it's in the same sentence.
Well, I think the legislature clearly did so, and that the legislature means what it says. And I think here it says where any person, association, or corporation is convicted of an offense, the court shall give judgment in favor of the state of Colorado for the amount of the cost of prosecution. And I think, you know, there's a lot of other, I think the plain language is clear here and that these costs are covered. However, I think there's a lot of other things, and I do believe that all of this evidence relates to all of the individual charges. I think that it's not as cut and dry as we would like it to be, as some other cases are.
But who makes that determination? Isn't that something that a trial court should do in the first instance? They're familiar with the record. They've tried the case. We don't have any findings dealing with, not only that, anything here. We just have an award for costs. I mean, under those circumstances, shouldn't we be sending it back to the court to make those kinds of findings?
I mean, I think that this is an inherent finding, that the trial court recognized that these are the costs that were related to this prosecution.
How did you know that? He didn't tell us.
By ordering the cost of prosecution, I think that, you know, that's a pretty influence to make.
Who were the experts and what did they testify to?
So there were four experts. There was the doctor who testified regarding the victim's injuries. There was the three CBI experts. There was a ballistics expert, a fingerprint expert, and a gun expert.
What did those have to do with eluding?
Well, I think if you look at what the elements of vehicular eluding and the elements of eluding or attempting to elude a police officer, for vehicular eluding, the prosecution was required to show that the defendant knew or reasonably should have known that he was being pursued by a peace officer. And for the eluding or attempting to elude a police officer, the prosecution was required to show, in part, that the officer had reasonable grounds to believe that the defendant violated a state law. So I think here, by presenting evidence of the experts and the victim, the prosecution was able to show that the defendant, by driving his co-defendant away from the shooting, knew that the police would be following him, and also knew that the police officer also showed...
Well, the eluding only starts when he takes off after the officer stops him.
But I think it's important to show, and we don't know what funds of evidence the jury is relying on for this conviction, which I think is the problem and the difference between...
You're avoiding the question. What do those experts have to do with the defendant driving away after he's been stopped by an officer and engaging in a high-speed chase?
Well, I think especially the victim is going to show the mental state that why the defendant was driving away from the scene.
Prior to this, the victim has testified as to what happened.
Right.
He's also testified that he rammed the defendant's car on, totally in his own car. Isn't that an adequate impetus to elude if you're going to elude?
But if we don't have that information from the victim and the doctor's testimony corroborates...
We do have that information from the victim.
But the victim was an out-of-state witness, which was part of the cost of prosecution.
Well, we might be able to recover the cost of bringing the person back.
But I think the doctor's testimony corroborates that. And so I think that... We might not get a conviction if we just have the victim. That's the problem, is we don't know. These are so related. I don't think you can separate out the vehicular looting as clean as we're trying to do here. I think that all of this evidence overlapped and was intertwined. And I also think it's important that the defendant had proposed a duress instruction. And so throughout trial, the prosecution is trying to disprove the duress instruction. And so especially the CBI experts are helping to show that the defendant at some point had possession of the gun. And so I think all of these together, the plain language, the fact that this...
Expert witnesses had nothing to do with who had possession of the gun.
Absolutely. They had fingerprint analysis on the gun. There was fingerprint, ballistics, and
that's after all of the events. I mean, he admits he had the gun.
But these are important to disprove the duress defense. I mean, these all go together. It goes to show the elements, to show exactly what happened as to why he's, you know, fleeing from a very serious crime, not a minor incident. This is a shooting where the victim was shot in the head. I think all of this goes together. And I think if you look at some of the cases that we both cite to, I think, for example, State versus Moon, which was the Washington case, you have a conviction of burglary and an acquittal of rape. So clearly the laboratory costs regarding only the rape, I mean, I think that's a very different case than we have here. We don't know what specific funds of evidence are going, and some of the evidence is overlapping and showing that they are fleeing, you know, that the defendant is fleeing, and that the police officer knew something had happened because the victim ran into the police officer, and then the police officer tells. I think all of these relate to each other, and I think that we can't differentiate them as easily as the defendant is trying to do here.
I apologize. It's been a while since I've gone back and looked at the motion that the prosecutor filed, but are the kinds of arguments that you're making now, were those made in the motion, or was it simply, here are costs, please award them to us?
Well, and I think it's a mandatory cost. I mean, I think that's one of the distinctions that I just want to point out between the Kansas statute and Colorado. Colorado is mandatory. Most of the costs are mandatory. And so I don't think that these arguments really need to be made, especially because the prosecution realized that all of these things were intertwined.
Judge realize that that's what the prosecutor's theory was?
I'm assuming. I mean, obviously the order doesn't indicate the theory of why this was awarded, but I would like to point out that the statute is mandatory, and it's very different than the Kansas statute. If you look at the Kansas statute, they talk about court costs, and then they talk about additional court costs, which the additional court costs are really what are our costs of prosecution. And I think The Kansas statute is discretionary, and ours are mandatory, except for the catch-all subsection J, which talks about costs that are reasonable and necessary and are directly the result of the prosecution. So I think the statutes are set up very differently.
I see it at least that the costs have to be reasonable.
I think that there has to be a nexus. There definitely has to be, yes.
They have to, even though the statute doesn't use the term reasonable or anything like it, they have to be reasonable.
I would say reasonable in the fact that there has to be a nexus of some, it's similar to the restitution where there has to be a proximate cause of the restitution. I think that, for example, the burglary and rape situation where you have laboratory costs only that went to an acquittal, I think that that's clear. If that happened here, that would not be, cost.
That would not be reasonable.
Yes.
And I understand you disagree with that premise that they are separate here, but that's the defense's argument, is that these are witnesses who testified as to an issue that really didn't relate to the convictions.
Disagree with that.
Okay. Yes. But we don't know what the trial court was thinking here. I mean, this just didn't come up, did it?
Not specifically, but I think that it can be inferred from the order. And I think, a careful review of the record shows that these weren't as separated out as we would like them, as the defendant would be making them. So I see that I'm out of time, so I would ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction and the order for costs. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk about a few things that the Attorney General just raised. First, with respect to the Kansas statute is mandatory. This is the way that the language of the Kansas statute reads. If the defendant in a criminal case is convicted, the court costs shall be taxed against the defendant. So this is mandatory as our statute. The only distinction is besides the court costs, which, as I pointed out in the reply brief, is a distinction without a difference, because in the Kansas case, we're talking about witness fees and out-of-state witness fees, just like in this case. The only distinction is, again, in the Kansas statute, they talk about if the defendant in a criminal case. The Colorado statute doesn't even have that language about in a criminal case. And yet, the Kansas Court of Appeals in 2006 found that plain language stripped the trial court of discretion to assess costs of prosecution, which were necessary to charges resulting in acquittal. Now, with respect to the sentencing hearing record, the prosecutor's statement to defense counsel and to the court when it handed over the motion for cost of prosecution reads like this. Defense counsel has just finished her opening remarks on sentencing. Prosecutor says, "Thank you, Your Honor. If I may approach, I have a motion for cost of prosecution. I have handed defense counsel the evidence disposition stipulation. I don't think she's had a chance to go over it with her client." Now, clear that this is the first time this has come up. It's being handed to defense counsel at the hearing, and the prosecutor is the one making the record. The counsel hasn't had a chance to look at these documents that he's handing her. So in terms of defense counsel speaking up and saying, "I haven't had a reasonable opportunity to object," the prosecutor just did that. Beyond that, in terms of the evidence and how interconnected it is in this case, I'd like to point the court to Deputy Petaluna's testimony. And I think what's important to remember here is that in this parking lot altercation, Mr. Palermo and his colleague were not fleeing from police from the parking lot. They were fleeing from the shooting victim who had just rammed them in his vehicle. There were no police present during the events of the parking lot altercation. It's only after the shooting victim runs into a police officer, tells an officer, "I've been shot," that a police bulletin goes out. Officer Petaluna, who testifies directly after Officer Ben Joseph, the officer who runs into the shooting victim, testifies that prosecutor's question, "While you were stopping the vehicle, what information did you have concerning the vehicle?" "All I had is it was a brown Cadillac, is all I knew at the time." "What information did you have concerning why you were stopping him?" "Deputy Ben Joseph aired over the radio and had been involved in. It was a suspect vehicle. The shooter was inside who shot her victim." I would submit to this court that that's all the testimony that was necessary with respect to the parking lot altercation to prove the eluding charge. None of that has anything to do with expert witnesses, ballistics, gunshot residue, fingerprints, the medical doctor's testimony, the victim's testimony. And again, going back to those enumerated witnesses and fees that were presented in the motion for cost of prosecution, the analysis that the Attorney General was doing up here at the podium, talking about you know, the defense counsel could look at the motion when it handed to, when it was handed to her at the hearing, and try to remember who those experts were, and try to remember when they testified during trial. That's the exact analysis that defense counsel was prevented from doing at the sentencing hearing. And we're having discussion about that now. And then you have to go through the transcript and parse out. Now, given they were at a defense counsel obviously tried the case and was present. But still, when you get a line item motion that only reads expert fees, number, that reads out-of-state witness fees and costs, number, that doesn't tell you specifically whether you should be objecting to these things or not. You need at least a little bit of time for reflection. Now, and finally, the Attorney General also today referenced subsection 2J of the cost statute and the brief as well. And that, I would just like to cite to that language real quickly for the court. That language provides that the costs assessed pursuant to subsection 1 of this section, or section 1618.101, may include any other reasonable and necessary costs incurred by the prosecuting attorney or law enforcement agency. Now, two things about this very quickly. First, courts are already employing this reasonable and necessary test below to determine whether costs are reasonable or necessary to a prosecution. There's no burden, as the Attorney General might suggest, by employing that test and having trial courts parse out that distinction. And finally, Section 1618.101, if you go to that language, the costs in criminal cases shall be paid by the state when the defendant is acquitted or when the defendant is convicted and the court determines he is unable to pay them. Again, that doesn't answer our question where we have charges that result in conviction and charges that result in acquittal, but it does stand for the proposition that when the defendant is acquitted, it's well established in Colorado law that he's not responsible for costs of prosecution.
Thank you, counsel.
I see my time has run out, so I just ask that on issues 1 and 2 submitted on the briefs that the court reverse the conviction and remand for the trial court. Alternatively, that this court vacate the cost order, or if it can't determine from the record that which costs were necessary to which charges, that the court remand to the trial court for that determination. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be, we thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.